Looking for a guiding hand in your Amazon business? Wizards of Ecom Academy is here for you. Our personalized support system includes unlimited email access to myself and my entire team to help you overcome challenges and strategize effectively. Sign up for an exclusive rate at wizardsofecom.com/academy. Your personal e-commerce coach awaits. Welcome back to the Wizards of Ecom. My name is Carlos Alvarez, and I will be your host for the show. On today's episode, we have a very successful Amazon seller and fellow Wizards of Amazon group member, founder of QRX Labs, Alexander Fedorovich. Alex, welcome to the show. Did I get the name right?
Yes, you did. It was awesome. Thanks, Carlos. How are you?
Awesome. Alex, I'm stoked to have you on the show as you're successfully doing something that I've wanted. I've actually started some businesses with the intentions of pivoting them into something you do. So it's been very high on my list of priorities, and it's been elusive to me, and that's manufacturing my own product in the United States. In this case, we're saying United States because we're both in Miami, Florida, hence the United States. My goal on the show is to be able to learn from you on how you did it, maybe the pros and cons. Who knows? Maybe you wouldn't even do it again. Like that's the idea. We met at, I think it was Cross Border Task Force e-commerce, like a really, really long name event at the local airport. You met Alex Sace and I speaking. I believe that was that event.
Yes.
And we were talking about Mercado Libre and Amazon respectively. And I just remembered that. I think we were just at Bonefish Grill talking, and it just dawned on me that that's where we met, right?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. So since then, you've been a big part of the group. You're always jumping in and helping people with a lot of, you know, tough Amazon specific stuff on just, you know, entrepreneur, good business sense stuff, and have become a friend. So I am very excited to have you on the show. And as I mentioned above, we're gonna unpack, or I'm gonna take advantage of your time here and unpack manufacturing in the US. So
let's jump into it.
I dawned on me, like I tried to do some research before the episode and like check out some of your YouTube videos, your podcast, previous speaking engagements. Nada. Nothing. I found nothing.
I don't speak publicly. I do it this time because it's you, but I don't speak publicly.
I didn't find your courses. I didn't find courses. I didn't find anything.
I don't sell courses.
Right? So the only way somebody can get information from you is going to be here, or if they attend the group and catch you at one of the events.
Pretty much.
All right. Let's kick it off this way, because I don't even know this. And you know, what is your origin story, and how did it take you into the world of entrepreneurship, Amazon?
Sure. Okay. So let me give you I'm going to try to make it short because it's kind of a long story, but you know, let me tell you a little bit first about my background, because I think that it's also relevant, and I think that all other people can identify with that also. So I'm originally from Montreal, from Canada. Was born, grew up in Montreal. Both my parents are European, so they're both immigrants in Canada. They're both Canadian now. They've been there for like more than 50 years. But that was part of my background also. And so I grew up in this mixed, you know, immigrant, partially European, partially Canadian environment. Grew up in Montreal, studied at University of Montreal. I studied computer science. So my background is really technical. My background is technology. It's about programming, and it's about software development. And so I studied that, graduated, went directly to work for IBM. So got hired straight out of university by IBM, went to work for IBM in Canada for like a couple of years. It was a good way to start, just to be exposed to the technology industry. Obviously, IBM is a major brand, you know, worldwide. So I got to know a little bit about how a large technology company works and all that. I didn't love it. It was kind of boring at that time, what they had, you know, new recruits do. So just software maintenance and different things, a little bit all over the place. I lived a little bit in Toronto and Montreal. And so I resigned after a couple of years, and I joined a friend, and we started a derivative trading company. And we raised money from a bunch of investors, and we built a computer model to trade basically mostly futures and some options. And so we did that for like a year. We raised the money. We started trading that money as a fund, as a private fund. And we did well in certain things, did not so well in other things. after a year, we had made some money, but barely any money. And I thought the stress was just amazing, like just investing a lot of money from third parties, from other people. I didn't like it. I just felt like it was just a lot of liability, a lot of pressure and all that. By the way, we were very young, still almost like out of college. So we decided to shut that down and move on. And at that point, I relocated to the US and started working on an IBM project as a consultant and built a product for IBM in the healthcare industry. I did that for a few years, learned a lot more about technology, about software development, working on that project, made a lot of good connections there also. And then it was 1999 when like the whole internet craziness started, right? Mostly on the West Coast. I had finished with that project at IBM. I did a 6-month stint at NASA in Washington, D.C., working on the ground control center for Hubble Space Telescope. I didn't really like that so much also because the project was interesting, but the environment was very like public sector, kind of like slow and very bureaucratic. So that was not really my thing. I wanted to do things fast. I wanted to do new things. So I moved to the West Coast, went to Silicon Valley. I joined an ex coworker and we started an e-commerce ASP. So basically offering e-commerce as a service to other companies that wanted to sell stuff online, right? We're talking about 1999, right? This is like the beginning, almost like the beginning of e-commerce, right? So we start basically offering e-commerce service to large companies. We had customers like Oracle, Netscape, America Online. I mean, these types of companies. And we're basically selling stuff for them online and fulfilling orders with a partner from Silicon Valley. And that was very interesting. I mean, I learned like a ton, around e-commerce at that point. That was really like, you know, both hands in, you know, this is a whole different era. Like today, it's funny because I talk to very young people, right, who are just starting. They're just out of college, right? And they're starting and they're doing Amazon or they're doing Shopify and all these things. And they're like, wow, yeah, you know, like, yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure how to do this. I'll do that. It's kind of complicated sometimes. And man, in those days, that was complicated. I mean, I was writing software code to interface directly with credit card processing gateways. This is the kind of stuff you needed to do if you wanted to sell online. I mean, it wasn't about, there was no Shopify, there was no shopping cart application, nothing. We built everything from scratch. So I started like at the very early stages of e-commerce and we did a lot of that. We learned a lot around, you know, everything from credit card processing to fraud to everything else. Did that for 4 years. Then the bubble burst, as everybody knows, everything kind of went down in Silicon Valley. It was a very depressing couple of years. I got tired. I moved back to Canada and then moved back to the US later on. I'm going to skip a few steps here because I moved around, worked for a bunch of different technology companies. And finally, after a few years, I ended up at Oracle. And then I spent the following 12 years at Oracle working in 4 different business units. I went all the way from consulting services in tech, implementing projects for large companies, to then doing business development for the healthcare industry throughout Latin America, out of Brazil. And then after that, another 5 years doing sales for the insurance industry, software sales for insurance industry at Oracle for Latin America and the Caribbean from Miami. This is actually how I ended up in Miami. So Oracle is the one that relocated me to Miami. And then as I was in the last couple of years of that career with Oracle, we started this Amazon business. So my partner and I, my partner, by the way, is actually my ex. So at that point, we're still together. We started that business together as a side thing, you know, almost as a hobby, really, right? Like with no real expectation that this was going to be anything big. And initially, the business was just about reselling products. So we didn't have our own brand. We were not even in the beauty segment. We were actually reselling products from other companies in the sport, you know, sport and clothing category, like sport clothing, basically waist cinchers, these types of products. And it really just started as a small business, reselling a few products on eBay and reselling a few products on Amazon. I was still mostly busy with my Oracle job, really, you know, traveling around like crazy and selling software and kind of supporting that small business on the side with some mostly technical help and some business help. and my partner, you know, like just basically operating the business. And then at some point we got really lucky because the Kardashians started posting on Instagram about some of the products that we were selling, and actually about the brand that we were selling, which is really quite amazing, right? Like, how would you like to just have a brand, start selling the brand on Amazon, and then have Kardashian start posting that that brand is like the best brand that's out there, right? It was just completely insane. It just kind of exploded, and our sales just grew exponentially over a short period of time. And we started just at that point, like for a period of about 1 year, our biggest problem was just getting enough product to meet demand. Like we just couldn't, the only thing we were doing is really just harassing the manufacturer to send us more product. And it was just kind of like, hey, here, I already have 10 orders lined up here in your pipeline. Just please ship me as much as you can. I'll buy anything you ship me, right? I mean, it was that kind of problem. It wasn't about selling. It was just about buying. It was just about buying enough product to just meet the demand, because any product that came in the door was basically out within like a week or less. So it was just kind of like, you know, as much product as we could get, we could basically just sell, which is really kind of amazing, right? I mean, it's really kind of a dream for anybody who's like reselling, right? This is like when you hit the, you know, the right product at the right time, and the product is just flying off the shelves. And your biggest concern is, how do I get more of that product? How do I get as much as I can so that I can maximize my sales and my profit? So we did that for a year and a half. We did really well. Unfortunately, we could have sold a lot more. There was just no supply, not enough supply for the demand. So we did as much as we could. And then after a year and a half, we saw that kind of plateau. And then we started perceiving that there was the beginning of a decline. You know, like it wasn't really a decline. It was kind of stable, but we could just feel that the interest and the demand was changing. And so at that point, we had finally accumulated a lot of inventory so that we could supply. And we saw that this had become a risk. And so we started, you know, being more careful about purchase, and we started liquidating. We started correcting some of our pricing and being more aggressive, selling more volume to reduce our inventory. And we did that at the right time, because over the following 12 months after that, that product kind of fizzled, right? And it never went to zero. I mean, it's products that are still selling today, but it just went back to the normal demand, you know, that it had like a couple of years before that. So like that whole craziness was kind of a fad. It went up and then went back down and went back to where it was before. So we were able to liquidate most of our inventory over a period of about a year. And that's when that year was crucial for us. That was like a, that was a pivot for us, because that was a year when we focused on liquidating inventory. We had a massive amount of inventory. We had inventory up to the ceiling of our warehouse. So we liquidated, and in parallel, I sat down and I looked at everything and I just reevaluated everything, because we had a full infrastructure to be able to do e-commerce. Yet we had a product that was declining, and where I didn't see that there was a lot of potential in the long term, like future potential. So I started looking at a lot of different categories and trying to reinvent the business on the fly, because like I said, okay, either we close everything down and we lose all of that infrastructure that we put together, or we reinvent the business over the next few months and we move in a different direction. And that's when we started looking at a lot of different categories, and looking at these categories, we came to the conclusion that beauty was a very interesting category, and more specifically skincare within the beauty category. So that's where we decided to focus. One thing that we learned from the whole experience with reselling products from a third party was that it's very difficult to be successful consistently long term when you don't control the source of the product, right? When you don't control the manufacturing, the source of the product, the pricing, and when you don't control all of these factors, it's very difficult, because a manufacturer can run out of capacity. That happened to us. A manufacturer can sell their product to a whole bunch of other distributors or resellers at different prices. And these resellers can then resell it at whatever price they want, potentially, right? Yes, manufacturers try to control pricing and everything, but it's not that simple. It's not that easy. We all know that, right? So a lot of these challenges, like we looked at and we said, you know what, we need to move away from that, and we need to control our destiny. To control our destiny, we need to have our own brand. When we have our own brand, then we control our destiny. So two of the goals were finding the right category to release new products and sell products within, and also having our own brand. So doing that under our own brand. And so that's where we decided to just focus on skincare and actually build a skincare brand like from scratch, right? So we spent part of that liquidation year. We were still ramping down the old model to create a brand identity, create a concept, look at different products, start planning, you know, on our what our products would be, what our product line would look like, what we would start with, and all that. And we started very slowly. I mean, we literally, when we launched the brand, we started with one product. Like, we launched one product just to go through the whole process and to see, you know, what we needed to do, what were going to be the hurdles, what were going to be the challenges, how we were going to address them, how we were going to correct the course if we needed to. And so we started with one product. It was basically one serum. And then from there, we just went like building up our product line in a logical way, trying to find products that would be complementary so that we could offer bundles, or we could offer, you know, treatments to customers where we could cross sell some of our products or cross promote some of our products. And from there, we just went, you know, building the company around that concept. So it hasn't been like a straight trajectory, right? Like it's kind of a twisted story. And the company today is very different from the original idea when the company was created. Actually, the name of the company is not even the name of our brand, right? Like, our brand is Curex Labs, or our company has a completely different name because the company had never even started with that concept. It changed over time, right? Which I think is like, that's it's a whole other topic, but I think that is very important when you start a company to understand that when you're a startup, you may have to pivot, and you may have to pivot multiple times over time, right? To be able to be successful and to be able to survive also in some cases. So that's something I think that anybody who starts a business, you know, of course it depends on the type of business also, but I think when we're talking about the kind of businesses that we run, like e-commerce, you have to be flexible. You have to be ready to pivot, to understand the situation and to react to it and to make some decisions. Sometimes you have to pivot pretty heavily as we did over time. And it worked out. It wasn't easy, but it worked out. That's kind of a summary.
That is a lot, man. That is a lot. I was not expecting that. That's really amazing. I that's insane. Okay, so let me ask you this. The serum, though, let me touch on that. The first serum you came out with, mm-hmm. did you actually, you manufactured that serum?
No. Okay, so that's a very good question, because obviously when we started in skincare, we're a brand new brand. We're new in a sense. We're a new business in skincare. We're not completely a new business because we've been doing other things, but they're not that relevant, right? So we're starting in skincare. So obviously we don't have a manufacturing capacity initially. We don't have all of the expertise to manufacture a good product in the right way. We don't have all the right processes. We don't have all the right expertise or all the right human resources to do that. So initially we started by simply finding third-party laboratories that could formulate and manufacture product for us in bulk, right? So that was kind of like a shortcut. Of course, as anything, it has advantages and it has disadvantages, and we can talk about that later. But we found different laboratories that could manufacture product in bulk, ship us product in bulk, and we started initially investing in our capacity to package product, basically. So we started with packaging, right? Receiving product in bulk and being able to bottle it, seal it, label it, package it, and sell it, right? So that's because, kind of like where we started from.
Because what you're receiving in bulk is what? This massive tank of liquid?
Yes, correct. This serum that's been already manufactured, is made, is ready, it's complete, but it's not bottled, right? So it's, as you said, it's a massive amount of liquid gel, whatever, you know, depending on the product, cream, liquid gel.
Can you share roughly what, if you remember, like roughly what was the cost of this tank of serum liquid, plus how much did you invest in the machinery to
look package? We honestly started at a very, very, very small scale. So we started with relatively small quantities, paying slightly higher prices just because we weren't buying huge quantities, right? So probably talking about, you know, maybe initial quantity, I don't know, 1500 or 2000 ounces of product, right? I mean, these are products that sell in very small quantities, right? So usually if we talk about most serums sell in a quantity of about 1 ounce, right? 1 ounce, you know, some serums may sell at a half ounce. Some serums may sell at 2 ounces. Like it varies, but you're talking on average, the typical size is of 1 ounce, right? Size, right? So, you know, if you want to start with a product and you think, okay, I may need to have 1,000 or 2,000 units to get started, well, you're basically talking about buying, you know, 1,000 or 2,000 ounces of product or finished product, right? And then when you talk about bottling and labeling, there's a lot of solutions out there. And there's solutions all the way from, you know, at the high end, there's solutions that will cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to automate that process in a very automated, very high volume way. But there's also at the very low end, there's solutions that are semi-manual towards more manual. You know, I'm saying semi-manual, but they're almost manual. So they're very simple mechanical machines that don't have any complexity around electronics or automated controls or anything like that, that you can use at a small scale to do that, right? You can use that to bottle, to seal, to label. And by the way, there's a lot, this is not new, right? I mean, companies, small companies out there, mostly in the food industry, that still do a lot of these things very manually. If you look at, you know, there are some wineries that only produce 1,000 bottles a year, you know, like that's just a reality. They produce 1,000. I mean, these guys don't have an automated packaging line or anything like that. These guys have a very small manual machine and they use that to bottle their wine and to seal their, you know, to seal their wine. I mean, so there's a lot you can do all the way from the very manual to the very automated. And obviously the cost of that varies substantially, right?
Awesome. So I want to touch on this. I didn't know you're like an undercover genius. You said NASA, IBM, Oracle, Silicon Valley. Those are some big names, man. I had no idea. Is Miami home now? I guess I got to send Oracle a thank you letter for that.
Yeah. Not Miami, but you know, I moved around a lot. I moved around all over. I started in Montreal, but I lived in Washington, D.C. I lived in Virginia, Maryland. I lived in San Francisco. I lived in Silicon Valley, also towards San Jose. I lived in Chicago. I lived in Sao Paulo. I lived in Peru also. I lived in different places. But I really like Miami. I think for me, my kids like Miami also and all that. For me, it's a good place. A good place also to do business for various reasons. So I like it. For me right now, it's my base. I'm happy here. No plans to move anywhere.
I love the sound of that. You said something else though that I wanted to touch on, because I feel like a lot of businesses, this is actually their failure point, that you didn't use the word forecasting, but at some point between having a full-time demanding job at Oracle, running another business, constantly struggling to like get inventory and having this problem that all business, you know, business owners want to have, they just can't get enough inventory. It's selling so fast. You still found the time to really plot out the trajectory of like how sales were going and where you would be in a year to start liquidating and downsizing and not getting caught with a lot of stuff. Did I hear that right? And where did you get that? Because most business owners don't have that. Like I've actually made that mistake several times. You don't really learn it until you get burned. Do you feel that it was skills that you picked up, I don't know, in college or in your other businesses that you applied here?
Yeah. So it's a good question also. Definitely, experience. Yeah. Experience makes a big difference. And, you know, I mentioned that I had this e-commerce ASP, e-commerce service provider, startup back in Silicon Valley. And from 99 to 2002, we ran that for 4 years, right? I was still very young. I had very little business experience. And looking back today, it's like, for me, it's like, it's amazing how many mistakes we made. You know, it's like, I look back and I'm like, wow. I mean, if I was back in that situation with the experience that I have today, it would really be, I think, a completely different story. We still did well, but we did well because like the whole environment was just, you know, incredible. I mean, just like there was so much activity, so many opportunities, so much business, but we could have done even much better. It's just, so experience is a big factor. I think experience is a big factor. I think the other thing also is like when you have a business, you have to be able to take the pulse of your business on a regular basis. When I say regular, I mean on a daily business, like on a daily basis. I look at my high level numbers on a daily basis, just key metrics, right? Like sales, orders, ad spend, you know, just like a few metrics at a high level. And I just, most of the time, I don't do anything about it. I just look at it every day. But when you look at it every day, when something happens, you perceive it. It's like it's just pattern recognition. Like your brain perceives that something is changing, right? Sometimes you're not even sure what. I mean, in some cases, like I've had already multiple cases where my ad agency, you know, my ad agency runs all of my ads. And so I just look at impressions, ad spend, you know, sales from ads, from ads. And a couple of times, you know, like I just watch the numbers, and after a couple of days, I'm like, something's not right. I don't know why, but something's not right. And I called them and I was like, guys, look at everything. Something's not right. And sure enough, like every time they had made some kind of mistake in a spreadsheet somewhere, you know, and they adjusted bids in the wrong way. I have no idea even like what they did, you know what I mean? But just like looking at the top line, looking at the big picture, if you look at it every day, you start perceiving these patterns and you start. So it was the same thing, like with these sales, you know, I could see like the patterns, I could see the orders, I could see the demand, I could see everything. And when I looked at it over time, at some point, I just started feeling like, something is changing right now in this market, and the demand is changing. And usually I think when you perceive that, you have to react quickly. Like you can't just sit around and say, hey, let's see what happens, right? Like we'll see in 6 months, you know, if we're still alive, you know, you can't do that. Like you have to react and you have to adapt, and you have to think like, what can I do to try to adapt? What can I do to be careful? What can I do to manage risk? What can I do to, you know, minimize risk, et cetera. I mean, I think that's basically like, and you never do it perfectly, right? I mean, we mess up every day. Still, I mess up every day, you know, like I look back the last 12 months. I mean, there's a couple of things I could have really done better that would have saved me money and problems, but hey, it is what it is, right? You learn.
Yeah. But being able to say that also allows you to apply it moving forward. Whereas I feel like most people don't even look at it. Like they look at it when it's like, oh my God, rent is due and there's no money in the account. What happened?
Well, you learn from that also.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I think I've learned everything the hard way. I think, in my experience, no IBM, no Oracle, no NASA. Like I learned everything the hard way. Something else I want to ask you, and we can skip this, but I just, you mentioned that you were in business with your partner, your ex now. Was that the reselling wholesale business, or are you also partners in QRX Labs?
Oh no, it's the whole thing. We're still partners today. Actually, she runs operations basically, and she's CEO of our company, and I am focused on strategy, finance, sales, marketing. I mean, that whole front part. Yeah.
It sounds like something out of like Mr. and Mrs. Smith, like almost, you know what I mean? Like that could create some tough things. Do you, all right.
That's, well, we have very different skills, and we have very different, interests also. Like, she doesn't like sales. She doesn't like marketing that much. She doesn't like finance. She doesn't like, you know, numbers. She's really more, more of a people person. She's operational. She likes to work with the team and, you know, and make sure that, you know, everything is done properly and we follow the processes. And so that's what she's good at and what she likes. And I think a lot of conflicts happen with partners when there's two or three different people who are trying to do the same thing, right? And then that creates like a lot of conflict, because like if you have two people who are sales oriented, who are, you know, supposedly, you know, one is doing one thing, the other one is doing something else, but, you know, one is always going to have an opinion about sales, right? No, well, we shouldn't do it like that. No, we should have presented it this way. Well, we should have talked to that company. We should have closed that deal. You know, so that creates a lot of conflict. I think when people are focused on different things, it minimizes, you know, friction. So.
Well said. What does the average day look like for you? I mean, since you're a manufacturer versus a non-manufacturer?
The average day right now for us is crazy. I mean, it's a whole operation. So manufacturing, as you can imagine, is a whole other level of operational, right? I mean, it's very operational. Like you have to have machines, you have to have people, you have to have all of the parts that you need, right? From your bill of material to put together your product, whatever product it is, right? So it's a complicated operation, right? So we depend, like it's an operation where everything has to work smoothly, because as soon as one piece of it doesn't work, like all the rest stops, right? So like if our purchasing makes a mistake and they don't purchase the right amount of ingredients that we need to make a product, well, we just can't make the product. It doesn't matter that we have all the other, you know, 99% of the ingredients, that we have the balls, that we have the caps, that we have the labels, that we have everything, that the machine is ready, that is clean, that the operator is there. All of that doesn't matter, because like if the ingredient is missing, we just can't make the product, right? So it's very demanding, and it takes a lot of discipline to make sure that you always have everything you need at the right time in the right place to be able to manufacture the product on time and deliver it on time, right? So that's definitely a big concern for us always. I had kind of an advantage coming from an IT background, because I was able to apply technology to everything we do in the most efficient way, right? So like for a small company, we're well organized, and for a small manufacturing company of our size, we're very small. For example, we have a full MRP system, manufacturing resource planning system implemented that tracks everything all the way from inventory to manufacturing orders to allocation of parts for manufacturing orders to everything. I mean, so that's very important. Without that, it would be almost impossible to...
And you built that?
No, not at all. We're licensing a cloud-based solution for that. But what I'm saying, I had an advantage. It's not for any like deep technical knowledge. It's just the fact that I've seen very large technology companies operate. So I've worked, you know, a lot with, I worked at Oracle for 12 years. I worked at IBM. I worked at these companies, and I've seen how a multinational company operates, how they leverage it. They leverage their systems to make sure that they're consistent, that they have processes implemented, that et cetera. So all of that helped me, because, you know, I think like if you want to build a company that has potential to grow, you can be the smallest company in the world, but you have to think like a big company, right? When you think like a big company, that's what allows you to grow, right? If you think like a small company, you will never be able to grow, because you will just hit a limit in terms of like processes, resources, solutions, automation, et cetera. If you think like a big company, well, you prepare yourself to grow, right? And then it's just a matter of making it happen, but at least you're there, you have the infrastructure, you're ready. So
do you ever see the movie The Founder?
Yeah, it's a good movie.
I have this visual for anyone that hasn't listened, watched it, that's listening. It's the basically the origin story of McDonald's. It's crazy, but there's this one scene in Founder that I don't know if you recall. They tore down the burger stand and they're on a tennis court and they're chalking out like where each thing is going to be inside for like maximum efficiency, no wasted movement and stuff like that. Like when I think of manufacturing in the US, like I'm imagining, like I'm visualizing something like that needing to be done where, you know, no wasted moves and everything's close to what it needs to be close to. Is it like that for you? And how did you go about that?
Yeah. So, of course, I mean, we always want to be as efficient as we can, right? So we look at everything we do every day, every week, every month to always try to see, is there something that we can improve, right? And there's one thing that's very important is that I think that you have to be very careful when you recruit. And here, I think we have an enormous advantage being in Miami. And that's one of the reasons I love Miami is that when you recruit people to work in your manufacturing operation, you want to have people who are going to be able to give you, at least give you, if they don't give you solutions, at least give you the feedback to be able to understand where are the challenges, where are the inefficiencies, and then come up with solutions to improve that, right? Ideally, if they can even suggest solutions, even better, right? So here in Miami, we have a fantastic team. I mean, we have the best team. We have people who are very, very dedicated. We have people who come with different backgrounds. The majority of our employees are all recent immigrants, actually, in the Miami area. I mean, we just know Miami, anyways, is a big immigration hub, mostly for Latin America and the Caribbean. And so we have people from different countries and with different backgrounds, but combined together, you know, some of them have a more analytical background, some of them have a more scientific background, some of them have a more business background. But combined together, they continuously give us feedback about, hey, you know, here's an inefficiency. Like we noticed that we waste time, you know, in this part, like how can we make it better? And sometimes that means purchasing additional equipment. Sometimes it means moving things around. Sometimes it means changing processes to use people in a different way, or to combine them in different types of teams. There's a lot of aspects, but yes, we look at that continuously, and we're far from being the most efficient today, but we're getting more and more and more efficient with time because we continuously improve, right? And we continuously analyze and we continuously try to invest to improve in our efficiency and how we use people and space and machines.
So no chalk.
No chalk.
I want to connect this to Amazon now. Like, in my mind, I have a China sitting on one shoulder and manufacturing in the USA sitting on my other shoulder. What? Here's a question: lead time. So if I want to order something from China, I have, you know, X amount of lead time. I assume you still have some sort of lead times from the time of I want to order something to it's ready to ship to FBA. What is that lead time for you?
Yeah, I have lead time, but my lead time is nowhere comparable to the kind of lead time you have when you have to import product from outside the country and everything, right? Okay. So I have lead time, but because I have an MRP system and I have a process in place to ensure that I'm always stocked up on material, ingredients, containers, packaging, and everything else, I'm actually able to turn around and reprioritize my production schedule almost overnight. And if I need tomorrow to start producing a specific product in a normal quantity, right, I could potentially turn that around within 48 hours. And that's a gigantic advantage. It's a gigantic advantage because I have agility. Like if one product takes off for me, most of the time I'm able to react instantly and I'm able to make sure that I produce faster and more units and continue to feed that sales cycle almost instantaneously while, you know, any company that uses a third-party manufacturing or outsourced manufacturing provider will never be able to achieve that type of, you know, lead time, right? So if you talk to most like outsourced manufacturing providers, the majority of them, I mean, you're lucky if they're going to turn something around in 1 month. You know, the majority of them today are like, wow, it's complicated. It's 2 months. It's 3 months. 4 months in some cases. I mean, imagine you're selling a product on Amazon and your product accelerates and your lead time is 3 months. I mean, like how do you deal with that? So it's complicated, right? I mean, it's a complicated equation. And I think that's one of the advantages that manufacturing gives you. It has a lot of complexity and cost associated to it, but it gives you also a lot of advantages, right? And I think here, like, you know, one parenthesis I wanted to make is that if you stop and you look at, you know, not just Amazon, but you look at business in general, right? And you look at, you know, how do small companies compete against large companies, right? And that's a big theme because like a lot of people, you know, look at different opportunities and they say, no, you know, I can't, there's no way I can do this business because I can't compete against the gigantic companies that are out there. But the thing is like, I think everybody needs to stop and needs to understand like what are the advantages and disadvantages of each, right? So like the very large companies, of course, has the advantages of known brand, you know, huge amount of resources in terms of money, people, etc. But they also have a lot of disadvantages. They're not agile. They're very slow. You know, in some cases, they have very bureaucratic processes internally that don't even allow them to do a lot of things easily. So when you're a small company, you have to double down on your advantages, your competitive advantages, right? And one of the biggest competitive advantages you have as a small company is agility and speed. Agility and speed. It's like a small company can release a product faster than any large company if they're good at it and if they focus on that, right? I can release a product 10 times faster than any L'Oreal, Neutrogena, Almay, and all these other large, you know, cosmetic companies in the world because they have a very complex bureaucratic long process and so many departments to synchronize and approvals and et cetera, and lead times in their own manufacturing facilities and everything. So if I can leverage that agility, that's one of the biggest competitive advantages that I have. So I think like that should never be neglected, right? As the more agile you can be, the more competitive you're going to be, at least against these other larger players that cannot be.
You said a few things there that all really lead into something else that's on my mind, and that is the role. First of all, have you ever launched a private label product where you were not the manufacturer?
Um, Well, I mean, when we started with our skincare brand, like I mentioned, like some, you know, some of the products, okay, we were just buying the product in bulk from a third party manufacturer, and there are some lead times. So already it's not as maybe as complicated because we were still bottling the product, labeling it, and everything. But there's still, that's still something we had to take into account, right? Lead time from the laboratory, right? Which may not be, you know, 3 months, but it's probably around 1 month. So still a challenge in some cases. Yeah,
that's right. So how does manufacturing versus not being the manufacturer impact product sourcing, if you will? Like, what am I going to launch? You know, is there, let me see how I'd ask this. Is it less risky to bring products to market when you're the manufacturer than it is ordering it from another manufacturer?
I don't know that it's necessarily less risky. I think it's probably about equivalent in terms of, the investment you need to do in promoting the product, launching the product, et cetera, right? Maybe the only difference, but I don't know that it's a difference that makes really that changes the equation, but maybe the only difference is that as a manufacturer, I don't have to produce a first lot that's going to be huge. Like, I don't have to produce 5,000 units of a product initially. I can produce only 300 units of that product. I can watch sales over the first 10 days, and I can decide whether the next batch is going to be another 300 or is going to be 1,000 or is going to be 3,000, right? So I kind of have that flexibility. And because I have that speed, I don't have to worry about launching a product, seeing that the product is accelerating right away and then running out of product, right? So that's an advantage. That's an advantage. But
do you leverage that? Like, because you technically could launch 300 different products and almost, you know their quality because you produce quality, and say, well, 50 stuck, they wouldn't have been on our roadmap otherwise. Let's just keep feeding them.
Yeah. So we kind of leveraged that, and we leveraged that really well in 2019, and we launched we launched about 10 products at the same time in parallel, which was our biggest, you know, like launch since the beginning of the company. Last year we had a lot of plans, but COVID had an impact on all that, right? Not necessarily because it had an impact on our sales. We did really well in terms of sales last year, but we had a lot of challenges last year in terms of logistics from our own suppliers, availability of containers from our own suppliers, just because of all the craziness around hand gel, hand sanitizer. And, you know, obviously we use a lot of the same suppliers, sometimes even some of the same mechanisms like pumps, treatment pumps, things like that, that were like, you know, almost completely gone because of like the hand sanitizer demand. So last year we really had to scale down our launch plans. I think we almost didn't launch anything. I think we launched one or two products last year. And now we have like some of these products have accumulated, and now we started launching again like this year. But we started slow because still there's a lot of inconsistencies with suppliers right now. This is still adjusting, and I think it's going to take another 6 months to finish adjusting. I think by the end of this year, we'll be back to a more normal environment. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Like, that's one of the advantages, that you can actually launch a lot more products faster in parallel, and you can test and you can see, you know, what works, what doesn't work, and then you just focus on the ones that do better, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Where do you draw the line with manufacturing? Like, for example, I'm thinking, if I'm going to get into manufacturing, I'll just say beauty serums. Let's go stay with serums. I'm going to manufacture beauty serums. I also need a machine to make my bottles, and then I need a machine to make my tape, and then to make my boxes. Like,
yeah,
you're still ordering some of those supplies, but how do you determine what's going to be done in-house and what's not?
Yeah, good question. So, yeah, I think for us, it hasn't been that difficult in the sense that, you know, there's certain things where it does make sense for us to manufacture, and there's certain parts where you get down to the level of like the parts where it really doesn't make a lot of sense. Because if you talk about containers like bottles, right? Bottles, caps, things like that. First of all, the manufacturing process is a whole other story. Like, you're talking about manufacturing plastic or glass or things like that. And to have a good cost, you would need to manufacture a gigantic quantity, maybe maybe a million bottles of the same size at the same time, right? Which really doesn't make any sense for us. I mean, we don't consume that amount of bottles. We don't have space to have the kind of machinery to do that. It wouldn't be profitable to do that, I think. So, you know, there's certain things where you just have to look and say, okay, look, if I purchase, you know, instead, if I purchase 50,000 bottles from a manufacturer somewhere, you know, in the middle of the US, they're going to be able to offer me a fantastic price, and I don't have to worry about anything around manufacturing bottles, which is a whole other business. It's a whole other industry. It's other chemicals, components, et cetera. So that wouldn't make any sense. So we just purchase all of that, you know, but even then, like, we've learned how to, you know, over time, as you scale also, that's another thing. As you scale, you start purchasing from small distributors. And as you scale, you start purchasing from larger distributors. And in some cases, we're now purchasing from manufacturers directly, right? For containers, which obviously has a lot of advantages in terms of costs. You have to purchase larger volumes, but, you know, it compensates. Now, if you talk about another aspect, labels, for example, right? Labels for products. Printing labels is a whole business, right? There's a whole bunch of companies. All they do is printing labels. For us to have like a press to print labels wouldn't make any sense also. I mean, it's a whole other business where you have to leverage your press almost 24 hours a day to make it profitable. So there's no way that we would be printing enough labels to use that type of equipment, you know, around the clock, right? So that wouldn't make any sense also. It's more efficient. So you have to look at what's efficient and what's not efficient, right? I think if you're going to manufacture, you have to look like, where are you gaining an advantage, whether it's financial or whether it's in speed or agility, and where you're not gaining any advantage, right? We wouldn't gain any advantage in manufacturing our own containers or printing our own labels. But we do have a huge advantage in being able to compound our own final products, bottle them, label them, and ship them out. So that's where we focus, basically.
Right. So even though you're not making the bottles, you still have the machinery that will allow you can put your product in and it will feed into those bottles.
Correct.
Okay.
We have the machinery to fill the bottle, close the bottle, seal the bottle, label the bottle, code the bottle, right, with expiration date, lot number. I mean, all these things like you have to do, right, when you package.
And the only manual part there is you have to order the bottles, receive them, and feed them into the machine.
Yeah, I mean, some of the we don't have a fully automated end-to-end production line. So there's still a lot of manual steps in there, right? Like, for example, you know, if we apply labels, we use a machine to apply labels where somebody has to like feed the bottles on a conveyor and they go through that machine. And when they come out on the other side, like they're labeled basically, right? And then somebody has to recover these bottles and either put them in a box or move them to the next step. So there's still a lot of manual, handling, but it is semi-automated with machinery, obviously.
Cool. Last question, and then I want to be respectful of your time. Well, actually, two questions here. One is, how does manufacturing impact cash flow versus not being a manufacturer and, you know, buying from your supplier?
So I think in general, I mean, I think it has two opposite effects. I mean, in the sense that it does require some capital investment, right? Because if you're going to be purchasing machines, equipment, and all that to be able to do manufacturing, that requires some amount of investment. Here, parenthesis, again, like depending on how you do it, depending on where you purchase machines, depending on how, you know, the type of machines that you purchase, it doesn't have to be a huge investment. A lot of people think like, oh, manufacturing. No, manufacturing, like you need to have millions of dollars to manufacture. No, you don't need to have millions of dollars to manufacture. That's definitely a myth. You can build a manufacturing operation with relatively reasonable capital investment. So that's one aspect. But on the other aspect, when you're manufacturing, typically you will have larger margins because you're the manufacturer. There's no intermediary. There's no third party in the middle that needs to have their own margin. So you do get better margin. And that's and better margin means that you have less capital required to invest in, you know, the actual inventory, whether it's inventory of parts or inventory of finished product. That inventory is actually costing you less. It's less of your money that's invested in there. So I think that kind of compensates a little bit, maybe, some of the investment that's required in the machinery. Overall, I think we have very good cash flow. I think, and when I look and when I talk to other people who have other models, like, people who just do reselling and all that, I think we have better cash flow overall. I see a lot of people talk about needing financing, having cash flow issues to grow and all that. We have zero cash flow issues to grow. Like, we don't use any financing whatsoever. We have banking lines of credit that we don't even use. We're cash flow positive every single month. I mean, we don't have cash flow issues. So I think it's an advantage. Yeah.
Does it make sense for you? Have you ever explored white labeling, kind of like to keep the machines going and all of that? That I hear a lot with manufacturing. It's like, anytime your machines are not, bottling or compounding, then they're not making money. Does it make sense to do this, what you know how to do, and manufacture for other people?
We've had different companies contact us about that, and it may be something that we could explore eventually, but right now it's not our focus. We're really just focused on continuing to grow our product line, continuing to grow the brand and all that. And, I think there's always a lot of opportunities. There's always a lot of things that you can do. But I'm also a fan of trying to maintain everybody focused on one thing, because when you try to do too many things at the same time, not only is it more complicated, obviously, because then, you're talking about white labeling. It's different customers. It's a different business model. It's a lot of different pieces in the equation. And the other thing also is you tend to distract your employees, right? When everybody is just focused on one mission, I think you tend to see typically better results than trying to have them do two different things, in parallel. So I'm trying to keep everybody just focused on the mission right now.
I love it. I appreciate your time. Was there anything that I didn't ask regarding manufacturing that you're like, you need to ask this? Like, people need to know this part of it.
No, you know what? I don't think that there's anything that you didn't ask, but maybe like my last comment would be that I would actually encourage people and entrepreneurs, other sellers or other people thinking about launching businesses on Amazon or even just online, I would encourage them to consider manufacturing. I'm not saying that manufacturing in the U.S. is necessarily the solution for everything. It certainly is not the solution for everything. But I think that it is a solution that a lot of people today are almost like eliminating by default. It's like, no, everything is made in China. The U.S. is too expensive. There's no labor. It's too complicated. It's impossible. It can never work. And in some cases, it is true. And in some industries, it is true. But there's also other cases where you can do a lot of things in the US and you can still make it work. You just need to find like what are the areas where it makes sense. You need to find the right geographical area to do it, where you're going to have the right labor, the right environment, the right, fiscal maybe incentives and everything. But it is doable and it can give you a huge advantage. So, I'm a fan. Right now, when I my career was not focused on manufacturing, but now that I am working in manufacturing, I see a lot of opportunities to do things in the U.S. and it can work financially, and the equation can work. It depends on the industry and it depends on the type of product and the kind of brand that you're building. So I would encourage people to actually just at least analyze or consider that, because I think that there's really a lot of opportunities there.
I learned a ton, man. I'm already looking at a few of my businesses as boring now. And that's a scary thing for me, because I reach this point and kind of the switch goes and I can't undo the switch, because manufacturing's sexier than I thought, man.
Good.
Hopefully we become neighbors. I don't know if you picked a place finally or you're going to move your facilities out, possibly out near my way.
We're in that. We have 6 months to basically make a decision and move. So
I love it. I have a feeling yours is going to look a lot sexier than mine, my insect stuff, but we'll trade walkthroughs if you want. Alex, again, it's being super respectful of your time. Thank you so much for being on the show. I ask everyone that's on the show something, just because I'm a huge book lover, as you hear me talk about a lot, is what is your favorite book and why?
So it's not a new book. It's a book that's been out there for a while. If you can see here.
Oh wow!
Founders at Work. Okay, it's a very easy to read book. It's just a sequence of interviews with founders, mostly from the tech industry, but I think a lot of what they talk about applies, even outside of tech, and certainly applies to e-commerce, and just a lot of founders from different very well-known companies like Adobe, Apple, et cetera, et cetera. And it's all interviews. And I like this book because I think it's easy to read, but I think also it has a lot of lessons in there around startups, around building companies, around disruption, around, I mean, what the experience is also around starting a company, because a lot of people sometimes have certain ideas. There's a lot of myths, you know, going around, and people don't necessarily understand how, you know, how things happen and some of the challenges and also some of the ways that people make things happen. So I think it's a good lesson. It has a lot of fun stories and anecdotes and a lot of good tips also.
And you said the book has been around for a while. Who's the author?
Yeah. The author is Jessica Livingston, but it's literally written as interviews. Like, it's like questions and answers, question, answer, question, answer. It's a whole sequence of interviews, and it's been out there for like 15 years. Huh?
Have you read Tools of the Titans? Is it like that?
No.
Okay.
No, I haven't read it. All right. So this one's been around for like maybe like 12 or 15 years, something like that. So it's not a new book, but it's got a lot of stuff is very applicable in there. You know, lessons around like fail fast, you know, how to move fast, how to disrupt the industries. I mean, it's interesting. It's a fun book.
Well, I'm gonna order it now. That's kind of like my commitment, my little side benefit from the podcast is I get to hear books that guests find to be their favorite. And if I haven't read it, I just order it right after the show. So I appreciate that.
You'll like it.
You just cost me like $20. I hope to see you at tomorrow as we have PicFu presenting at the meetup in the afternoon on Zoom. And then I hope to see you Saturday at the meetup. I'll be presenting. So thank you so much for your time and for sharing everything. Not everything, but a lot of what you know about manufacturing. I really appreciate it. And I know the people listening to this kind of love it.
Thanks, Carlos.